It's BBC Radio 4 FM. Hillary Clinton will be talking to Jenny Murray in Woman's Hour at 10 o'clock here on Radio 4. But now it's time for our Book of the Week. Chris Stewart reads from his memoir, The Last Days of the Bus Club. A summer drought finally ends in December with devastating consequences for Chris and Anna and the farm.
Spain, with the exception of lush and sodden Galicia in the Atlantic northwest, is a country racked with droughts. And the southeastern quadrant of the peninsula, which includes Almeria, Murcia, and our own province of Granada, is probably the driest part of Europe, with a rainfall not much greater than that of the Sahara Desert. And, although the following statement tends rather to the emotional than statistical, of these driest parts of the dry, the driest of all is where we have chosen to make our stand, the Alpujarra. In fact, it is only the presence of the snows on the peaks and the aquifers beneath the Sierra Nevada and the beautiful and intricate system of irrigation devised by the Romans and the Moors that keep our lush green valleys from becoming desert. We often feel that we're living on the edge, on the delicately balanced frontier of a changing climate. The mean annual temperature in the peninsula has been higher these last few years than since the records began in about 1850, and not a winter passes without the violence of the weather causing mayhem and fatalities in some part of the country. Sometimes there's a warning, a vision of the way things might go. In 1995, for instance, the year scheduled for the Alpine Skiing World Championships on the Sierra Nevada, there fell not a flake of snow, and the event had to be postponed for a year. The old boys, who while away their days sitting at the entrances to the villages, came out in force to announce that never before had such a thing been seen. Everybody shook their heads and, with earnest looks, predicted cataclysm and doom, although it has to be admitted that these are scenarios much discussed and enjoyed in the Alpujarra. The English may admit to a dull fascination with the weather, but the Spanish border on the obsessive in their weather commentary, which is an odd thing, since in summer every day is a cloudless day and the sun beats on down as predictably as ever. After the agony of August is over, the first thing one does at the start of each day is scan the sky for sight of a cloud, that first harbinger of blessed rain. This is an activity fraught with frustration. And so it was, in Chloe's second year at college, that September crept in dry as a cracked stick, and it didn't rain in October either. Even in November, it only registered a couple of litres, according to Domingo's rain gauge, a wheelbarrow whose dimensions, he reckons, roughly correspond to the required square metre. December was no better either. Short, dry, sunny days. Lunch on the terrace. We told friends and family in less favoured parts of the world, where it was gloomy and wet, England mostly, how glorious our weather was. Chloe came home from Granada for Christmas. I fetched her from the bus stop in Orchiva. These are some of my favourite moments in life. That small, involuntary welling of the heart that must be how dogs feel when they lower their ears and wag their tail. On the night of her arrival, the 23rd of December, to our intense relief and delight, the drought broke and the heavens finally opened. We sat by the fire, the three of us, listening to the rain as it thundered on the earth of the roof, danced zapateados on the skylight, and roared on the corrugated iron of the porch. This was rain like we had never heard rain before, though, and it made me uneasy. By 2 in the morning, the sound of the roaring of the river that came up from the valley drowned even the infernal thundering of the rain on the roof. I lay wide awake in bed, wondering what we would find in the morning. At 4 on the morning of Christmas Eve, the river sounded as if it were raging from the gorge like the hordes of Beelzebub. The phone rang. Nobody rings you that early in the morning unless there's something really serious going on. It was Domingo. "Cristobal," he said darkly, "can you get me the keys to your car?" "What do you mean?" I asked, although I had a pretty good idea of what he did mean. I've been down to the river, and it's tearing away the ground beneath the wheels. In half an hour, maybe sooner, you're going to lose your car. The car is parked on the far side of the river, on the highest ground in the riverbed, about 5 metres above the bridge. The keys hang on the back of the kitchen door. Domingo continued, "The bridge has gone. You've lost your water supply and the track on both sides of the river. The river has completely changed course and is about to take away the fields at the bottom of your farm. It's still growing, and there's no way of knowing what it's going to do. Have you got a set of keys over this side?" I could tell from the way that he was speaking that he was uncharacteristically rattled. There wasn't an awful lot I could do. There were no keys on Domingo's side of the river, and there was not a chance in a million of throwing the keys across the river, even if it were not swollen. So I went back to bed. With the first light of the morning, I fished out an umbrella, shook the summer's dead scorpions out of my Wellingtons, and squelched into a world that, having been hard and dry, had overnight become soft and sodden. The rain was still pouring on down, and although the cataclysmic downpour of the night seemed to have passed, the air was so full of water that it immediately condensed on my glasses. I wiped them with a rag I found in my pocket, but it only made them worse. So I took them off and walked with some trepidation down the track towards the rivers, the dogs trotting along behind. We hear the sound of the water all year round. In summer, it dwindles to the faintest susurration as the water trickles from pool to pool amongst the rocks. And in winter, it's not unlike the sound of distant traffic on a motorway. It's so constant that you barely notice it. This, though, was entirely different. The valley was awash with noise, the terrible noise of swollen and raging waters. The thunder of boulders crashing into one another punctuated the ceaseless roar of maddened water. The dogs moved through this awful scene, utterly indifferent to it. As for me, I stood on the corner, my jaw slack, spellbound by the sight of the river in flood. The rain lashed on down as I continued towards the lower fields of the farm. The sheep peered from the stable door as we passed. They weren't going anywhere. They hate to get wet. Finally, I caught sight of the Trevelyth River, rolling down the valley from the north. There was no way I could even get to where I might be able to see the car. Everything had gone. Where there had once been a rich vegetation of trees and bushes, and the road that led to the farm, there was nothing but river. Domingo was right. We had already lost a large part of the lower farm, and the water was still rising, and the rain was still sheeting down. The car would be good and gone by now. And we had lost precious land, too, land that represented years of cultivation and care, of hopes and heady schemes, with olives and oranges and apricots that now would never give fruit. There was nothing to be done, though, so, helplessly, and a little numbed by it all, I turned and trudged back up the hill. Anna and Chloe had woken up by now, and after a rather subdued breakfast, we decided to climb the hill above the house to get a clearer idea of what was happening. The rain had more or less stopped and given way to a breeze chasing towering clouds across the sky. We climbed, the three of us, to where we had a fine view of the whole riverbed. I scanned the valley to see if I could see what the river had done with the car. No sign of it. Perhaps it had been washed all the way down to the deeper water by the dam. I took my filthy glasses off and wiped them on my shirt. As I did so, Anna nudged me and pointed. There was the car, just about visible through my filth-smeared lenses, and almost where I had left it, but on what looked like higher ground, a little farther from where the bridge had been. Relief swept over me. Later, Domingo told me that he had gone down to the river with his tractor and dragged the car, which was locked, in gear, and with its handbrake on, back from the crumbling riverbank. I made a mental note that some day I would return the favour and do a great act of neighbourliness for Domingo. But then I remembered that his fierce independence and self-reliance made such gestures impossible. Well, I would see what I could do. The car was still there then. But the change wrought in the valley was almost beyond belief. Before, we had had a valley with earth and flowers and bushes and trees. There had been little Arcadian corners filled with beautiful wild asparagus and winding paths through groves of towering ailanthus. all that was gone. There was nothing to be seen now but a moving mass of water, and where this had subsided a little, a wilderness of grey boulders and gravel. Anna was very subdued. I consider myself to be pretty sensitive about landscape, but I'm not in the same league as my wife, for whom any harm that befalls the plants and trees that surround us is like a personal affront. The destruction we were witnessing was almost more than she could bear. There wasn't really much I could say either, as we all gazed down upon our ruined valley. There was no way in or out now. We had lost the road and the bridge was gone. The Athakia was completely destroyed, the lifeblood of the farm, that brought water along the hillside from the river. The pipe that had brought our house water from a spring on the far side of the river had been swept away too, and so, ironically, we were without water in the house for drinking, washing or cooking. The much cherished and nurtured kitchen garden down by the gate was under a metre of silt and gravel, with the river water spreading in a filthy sheet across it. All that work and all that hope just washed away. Potatoes, artichokes, greengages. I think it was fortunate for us that Chloe was home, for without that powerful motive to remain stoical and even attempt some semblance of optimism, Anna and I might have given in to gloom and depression. By Christmas Day, the rains had stopped. There was still no internet or telephone, as these conveniences seem to go down whenever there's rain or wind, so we settled down to a quiet family meal. You don't normally think of nettle soup as festive fare, but take it from me, if you whiz up your stinging nettles with a little potato for the texture, some garlic and onion, and a red-hot chilli to give it some edge, and you serve it in a dainty bowl with a swirl of soured cream and a handful of small golden croutons, and wash it down with a rich, strong-bodied ruby wine, well, the words will fail you as they're failing me. Next was lamb. It's always lamb at Christmas. If you keep sheep, you eat lamb. This one glowed in a spicy glaze of pomegranate syrup and chilies, and was stuffed with a whole posy of herbs from the hill. There was mojo picon to go with it, parsley, oil and salt, ground in the mortar and pestle with a little garlic and green chilli, and crispy roast potatoes, and a lemon tart to finish off. Good food enjoyed with people you love, I reflected, as I blew out the last of the candles and headed for bed, is a fine antidote to most of the tribulations of existence.
Last Days of the Bus Club was written and read by Chris Stewart and abridged by Pete Nichols. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. Tomorrow, the storm has abated and Chris and Anna try to get back to some sort of normality. But one family member poses a problem. That's tomorrow morning at 10:15. The news is next, and then Hillary Clinton will be talking to Jenny Murray about life at the political top table. That's in Woman's Hour. Hillary Clinton was offered the post of US Secretary of State in 2008 by Barack Obama, who just months earlier had been her rival for the Democratic Party's nomination for the presidency. She took the job, and with it the challenges of representing her country on the world stage. She'll be talking to Jenny about her new book, Hard Choices, about the tough decisions she faced in shaping US foreign policy. Also in the programme, in 1973, Billie Jean King performed in the most watched tennis match ever. She played the former tennis champion and keen chauvinist Bobby Riggs in the Battle of the Sexes. In a treat from our archive, she'll be talking about a documentary made to mark the 40th anniversary of that match. Woman's Hour is here on BBC Radio 4 in a couple of minutes. But first, let's take a look ahead to this evening.
The Report returns to BBC Radio 4.
The focus is looking behind the headlines.
These are pretty incendiary claims. MPs coercing staff into sex.
Finding the voices that haven't been heard before.
He sort of just became very inappropriate.
People were so afraid of what might happen that we had to actually get actors to read their words.
He was very touchy-feely in a way that was so outrageous.
It was really hard to get them just to talk to us in the first place.
A new series of The Report, starting this evening at 8:00.